Hello, my name is Karen O'Brien. I'm the head of humanities at Oxford University, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to the 2020 Besterman Annual Lecture. Of course, it's an annual lecture like no other. We normally greatly look forward to doing this in person, but we're so delighted that with the support of the Oxford Research Centre for the Humanities, we're able to bring this to you from the Voltaire Foundation, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing the lecture today. A particular pleasure for me because, as well as being Head of Humanities, I'm also myself a scholar of the Enlightenment. It's my great pleasure to introduce, as the introducer of the lecture, Professor Gregory Brown, who is a senior research fellow at the Voltaire Foundation and himself a considerable expert on the literature and drama of the Enlightenment, including Beaumarchais. And he's also been for a number of years the general editor of the Oxford University Studies in the Enlightenment book series, a book series that recently made a transition to a new publisher and a new way of working. And he has so ably and so importantly led that transition on behalf of the Voltaire Foundation and the University of Oxford. And he's going to introduce our enormously distinguished Besterman lecturer, Professor William Doyle. Over to you, Gregory, and welcome. And I hope everybody hugely enjoys this special occasion.
Thank you, Professor O'Brien. So I'd like to welcome the live audience, and I'd like to remind everyone that questions for Professor Doyle may be posted in the YouTube live chat, which you'll see below, and those will be addressed after the completion of the lecture and the panel of respondents. So over the past 40 years, the French Revolution has experienced something of a renaissance within the humanities as a point of conjuncture of several different important tendencies. It's continued to be a focal point for advanced studies in social structure, and scholars of the revolution have integrated important thinking about the role of the state in the economy with cultural and linguistic theory. The wave of scholarship that rose to a crescendo in 1989 has not ever really crested, due in part to the activity of a generation of scholars who entered the field in its wake. For that generation, William Doyle has been one of the most influential of historians. For undergraduate students in the Anglophone world, Doyle's name is recognizable as the author of The Origins of the French Revolution, first published in 1980, and The Oxford History of the French Revolution, which first appeared in 1989 and has been updated twice, the most recent edition in 2018. For postgraduate students and advanced researchers, Doyle's editorial oversight of the Oxford Handbook of the Ancien Régime, published in 2011, has provided a foundation for appreciating both the dynamism of the old regime and how the revolution constructed what it considered the former state of affairs prior to 1789 as a paradigm of obsolescence and atavism. In his own most significant monograph, Venality, The Sale of Offices in 18th Century France, published in 1996, Professor Doyle brought to fruition longstanding rethinking of the social conflicts of the late old regime, focused not on totalizing categories such as class or order, but on specific sites of conflict among elites. Whereas the idea of stress zones between nobles and bourgeois have been posited since the early 1970s, Doyle in this book demonstrated how the roughly 70,000 venal offices and the families which held them constituted at once a dynamic social network in and of itself, a powerful driver of political change from within the state, and a set of reference points for changing conceptions of status. In his most recent book, France and the Age of Revolution, Regimes Old and New from Louis XIV to Napoleon Bonaparte, Doyle has considered the rise and fall of the absolutist state and its reconstitution. Doyle's essays here highlight the extent to which the long 18th century now appears to us much less a world historical hinge or an epistemic break. Instead, through rigorous research and sensitive analysis, Doyle reveals a continuity of elites, especially for the decades from the 1770s to the 1810s. Even as the concepts, vocabulary, and representations used to exercise social and political power were reinvented. What has long been notable about Professor Doyle's work, and what makes it such a privilege for us to have him deliver this year's Besterman Lecture, is how he brings together the study of economics, of language and meaning, and of the exercise of state power. Doyle's work consistently provides us with avenues for research that have both spoken to and enlarged the interdisciplinary and international audience for 18th century studies. For those of us who are specialist historians of the revolution, Doyle's work has provided a crucial bridge from the post-war generation's rethinking of economic and social change in the 1950s and 60s to the more institutionally and politically oriented work on state power of the 1970s and 1980s, and then to the linguistically oriented study of political language and of culture in the 1990s and since. His work has been as important for the questioning of the Marxist paradigm of the origins of the revolution as bourgeois, as it has been to questioning the tendency of scholars to limit our focus to Parisian Jacobin political activists. Doyle has been a forceful advocate for understanding the importance of culture and belief, including religious belief, as not reducible to economic interest, and at the same time for appreciating the events of the age on a broad scale, national, continental, and even global. It is therefore for me, and I think for all of us, a particular delight to hear from this masterful teacher and influential scholar as he offers us his take on this central question. If not the constantly rising bourgeoisie or the utopian cloud conjurers of the Enlightenment, who were in fact the French revolutionaries? We now welcome to the Torch Big Tent to deliver the 2020 Voltaire Foundation Vestment Lecture, Professor of History Emeritus and Fellow of the British Academy, William Doyle.
Thank you very much, Greg. Thank you very much, Karen. And thank you to the Voltaire Foundation for inviting me to give this lecture in this unprecedented situation. Now, although I can't really say I ever knew him, when I look back, I realize that every stage of my student life at Oxford, from admission to my college through a viva in schools and on to acceptance as a doctoral candidate, I met and was beholden to Hugh Trevor Roper. And since he was a considerable authority, among many other things, on the Enlightenment, a lecture at the Voltaire Foundation seems an appropriate occasion to pay him a belated, if passing, tribute. Now, notoriously, he never produced the great book of which he dreamt, but he was a brilliant essayist. And one of his principles in this field was, and I quote, "It's a great mistake to give away too much in a title." Now, I'm sure he was right, and you may think that I should have borne it in mind in selecting my title today, because isn't it quite obvious who the French revolutionaries were? They were men, and they were all men, who overthrew the old regime of absolute monarchy and aristocratic privilege and sought to replace it with a new one based on representative government and guaranteed political and civil liberty and equality. To secure these things against reactionary enemies, they were compelled to take increasingly extreme steps, which only swelled the ranks of those enemies, ultimately antagonizing most of Europe. But in the process, they laid the foundations of modern political culture. Now, it was always a story that everybody interested in politics or public affairs, and not just history, has had to know something about, and could scarcely help taking a view on, whether for or against. But until the 1960s, it was, whether you approved of it or deplored it, an agreed story. And when you wanted to know about the revolution, you went straight to the authoritative French texts. Accounts in English broadly echoed surveys by Georges Lefebvre, who'd just died, or by his natural heir, as it seemed, Albert Soboul. They offered what Soboul liked to call a classic version of the French Revolution. The classic story was, in fact, an interweaving of two interpretative strands. The basic narrative was forged during the revolution itself in 1793-4. An orthodoxy promoted by the Jacobin Club, it depicted the revolution as a struggle for liberty and equality in which bourgeois and popular forces overthrew the powers of aristocracy and privilege, and then had to defend their gains against counter-revolutionary enemies at home and abroad. Now, these enemies were so determined that they deserved no quarter, and the problem for true revolutionaries throughout the first 4 years of struggle was to eliminate successive waves of moderates, monarchiens, feuilletists, Fayon, Girondins, moderates who, in the name of bringing the revolution to an end, were prepared to compromise with its enemies. And eventually it was found that only terror worked, a regrettable necessity perhaps, but a necessity nonetheless, and integral to the revolution. And the way those who brought terror to an end by overthrowing Robespierre began the moment he and it were gone to backtrack on the gains of 5 years in the so-called Thermidorian reaction, it showed how necessary it had been. The revolution was now over, and it was no coincidence that most of the classic accounts and their derivatives ended in July 1794, leaving the period between then and the advent of Napoleon a largely trackless historiographical wilderness. Anyway, that was strand one. But into it was woven in the first half of the 20th century a Marxist overview of the revolution. At this level, it was, in the famous words of Soboul, the crowning moment of a long economic and social evolution, which has made the bourgeoisie the mistress of the world. In economic terms, with its attack on feudalism and the jungle of economic restrictions symbolized by privilege, it marked the triumph of capitalism. In social terms, it marked the coming to power of capitalism's products and beneficiaries, the bourgeoisie. And in the popular movement of the sans-culottes, it also offered a glimpse of a future predicted by Marxism when ordinary working people would take over power from the bourgeoisie and establish the dictatorship of the proletariat. That moment had not yet arrived because, for the time being, the sans-culottes accepted bourgeois leadership. But already the bourgeoisie needed their own aims, as the decisive role played by the Parisian populace and peasants in 1789 showed. Not to mention the subsequent great popular journée, which brought down the monarchy, purged the moderate Girondins, forced the convention into accepting terror, order of the day. And accordingly, in the year two, that's 1793-4, the bourgeoisie were prepared to acquiesce in a whole range of what became known in the classic account as anticipation, anticipations of future socialism. But with the overthrow of Robespierre, the bourgeoisie shook off populism, turning finally to Napoleon to underwrite their triumph. So who in this classic account were the French revolutionaries? They were the ones who went the whole way, who triumphed in 1793, who thwarted the revolution's enemies at home and abroad and saved it from destruction. They were the ones who introduced a progressive program of economic on everything that they'd done since 1789, their track record of civisme and patriotism. They were the Montagnards who ran the Jacobin Club, who sat
Okay, so it appears that there's a bit of
myth of the French Revolution. But Cobbon made very little impact until the arguments of that lecture were incorporated 10 years later into his book, The Social Interpretation of the French Revolution, where he kicked off a debate whose effect was to blow the classic version of the French Revolution wide open. Not only did he put a new interpretation on a broadly agreed set of facts, he challenged those facts themselves. The story's familiar enough, and I'm sure I don't need to rehearse it in detail yet again. He argued that most of the men of 1789 or 1793 were not capitalists, that the revolution did not usher in all-conquering capitalism, but was a triumph for the conservative landowning classes. He made a wide range of other suggestions too, most of which stood the test of time a lot less well. But the most important thing he did was to trigger that wide-ranging debate and waves of new research whose results called into question many other aspects of the classic narrative. He's the founding father of what became known as revisionism. Now, across the channel, a parallel role was played by François Furet. But whereas the main weight of Cobbon's attack fell on the Marxist strand of the classic narrative, the ex-Marxist Furet denounced the Jacobin strain, what he called the revolutionary catechism. Under the weight of a generation of debate and new research, the classic story, now reduced from canonical supremacy to the status of one disputable interpretation among many, fell to pieces. So that by the time of the revolution's bicentenary in 1989, most people working in the field had turned away from the social and economic categories which bulk so large in classicism to emphasize the more nebulous areas of political culture, the role of ideas, language, discourse, a body of approaches which have come to be known as post-revisionism. Now, few post-revisionists have seemed prepared to come out openly and say it, but basically they've taken us back to a very old idea, and one that has the merit of being acknowledged by contemporaries, the revolution as the fruit of enlightenment. Now, everybody at the time thought that was self-evident, whether they were members of the assemblies or the Jacobin clubs, claiming endlessly that the revolution was the product of philosophy and the abandonment of bigotry, superstition, and routine, and setting up the pantheon to glorify the remains of figures like Voltaire and Rousseau, or counter-revolutionaries blaming a conspiracy of godless philosophers and Freemasons bent on destroying church, king, and the social order. So what, in these terms, were the key ideas that the men of 89 were hoping to establish? If we're looking for who the French revolutionaries were, we need to identify what. Now, the first place to look is in the revolution's founding manifesto, the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen, and more generally, in the new order that the Constituent Assembly tried to lay the foundations of. Successive regimes between 1789 and 1795 revered that declaration. And when the convention moved from the Manège to the Tuileries Palace in May 1793, the new chamber was dominated by a text of it in letters of gold. So let's try to summarize this revolutionary ideology. The revolutionaries of 1789 believed in national sovereignty. That's the essence of the first treaty on the 17th of June, 1789. From that moment, in their eyes, the king was no longer sovereign. Now, that didn't make most of them anti-monarchical. There was some republicanism in 1789, but really not very much. What the founding revolutionaries were against was despotism. Despotism in any hands, excessive concentration division of power. Revolution was about establishing the rule of law in all circumstances. And under the rule of law, power should emanate from below. Not above. Power guarantees all equal, but it.
There's a bit of a lag from Professor Doyle's internet feed right now.
Constitutional implications to that doctrine, rooted again in the thought of the Enlightenment. Freedom to enjoy your property meant freedom to buy and sell it, economic freedom. And the whole record of the Constituent Assembly as a governing body shows, I think, that its members believed in what they saw as the economic law of nature as much as the political. Economic activity should be free, unconstrained by feudal burdens, internal customs, corporate privileges, organized labor, price controls. All these things were abolished, abandoned, or prohibited between August 1789 and June 1791, always in the name of a beneficial freedom. So these principles then, universal in their validity, was what the revolution was supposed to be all about. And the true revolutionaries were presumably those who believed in them. Let's see then who this might let in and exclude. First to go, rather surprising ones, but the case against them, it seems to me, is more than credible. I mean, the sans-culottes. To start with, the sans-culottes didn't even exist during the Constituent Assembly. Michael Sonnenscher has taught us that the name was first used in its familiar sense only in the spring of 1792 by the journalist Antoine Louis Gossas, later a prominent and vocal Girondin. I'll come back to that. Secondly, the sans-culottes ideology, when it emerged, rejected any idea that property was sacrosanct, and indeed any link between property and political rights. The sans-culottes called for universal manhood suffrage, irrespective of wealth, and they believed that it was legitimate to limit the wealth of some in the interests of those who had less. And in any case, thirdly, they didn't really believe in representative government. They preferred direct democracy, despite the manifest impossibility of governing a country the size of France, according to such principles. Fourthly, they certainly didn't believe in any form of free market. They believed in the maximum price controls, state-guaranteed supplies of basic commodities. Now, for some historians, all this has made them look like proto-socialists, although Saboul was honest enough to conclude with evident regret that they were not really proletarians. Seems to me that with all these beliefs, they're much better seen as backward-looking seekers after a vanished world of governmental paternalism. And what's obvious is that they were deeply opposed to much of the ideology of 1789. They were a special interest group, and not a large one, in a country of almost 30 million people who behaved with indifference towards the interests or desires of the rest of the French nation. It's just that by the fortunate chance of having national authorities sitting unprotected in their midst and at their mercy, they were able to enforce their will for a time. Now, what gave them the reputation of revolutionaries was the praise heaped on them by the Montagnards, who, after initial hesitations, claimed to be their spokesmen and protectors in 1793-4. The Montagnards were the originators of the Jacobin strain in the classic version of the revolution. But how far do they themselves really qualify as upholders of the ideology of 1789? They're the ones who ran the terror and the self-styled revolutionary government associated with it in the year two. It was a centralized, authoritarian system of government with almost arbitrary powers vested in those neo-intendants, the representatives on mission. There was next to no separation of powers under revolutionary government. Executive ministries had been abolished in favor of committees of deputies. There was no independent judiciary, and the revolutionary tribunal was the sort of special court that the men of 1789 considered completely legitimate. There was no freedom of the press or opinion. Critical newspapers were closed down or had their presses smashed. And a thoughtless remark in the wrong hearing could send someone to the guillotine. There's little respect for property either in the year two, with threats of redistribution to needy patriots and forced loans on the rich. And then finally, there's no free trade in perhaps the most tightly controlled economy the world had ever seen till then, the regime of the maximum. The Republic of the year two, in fact, was a dictatorship embodying the opposite of almost everything that the men of 89 had set out to establish. And insofar as some of the most prominent characters of the year two, men like Robespierre or Barrère, that had also been among the idealists of 1789, they had abandoned the revolution's original founding principles. And we can symbolize it, I suppose, by the famous contrast between Robespierre of 1794, who sent opponents to the guillotine, and his lonely denunciation of capital punishment in 1789. The fact is that the government of the year two, which called itself revolutionary, was nothing of the sort. If anything, it's anti-revolutionary government. A very distinct version of this argument has been put forward to a good deal of scholarly outrage by Jonathan Israel. Now, there's a stock answer to this sort of charge, and it was offered right from the start in Robespierre's famous distinction between constitutional government for the enjoyment of the revolution's fruits and revolutionary government for achieving them. You had to be practical. This was an emergency, and with foreign domestic and domestic enemies threatening to overturn the infant republic, normal constitutional government had to be suspended. So what distinguished a Montagnard or a Jacobin was a willingness to sacrifice principles to practicality. In the emergency circumstances of 1792-4, it was necessary to execute the king, necessary to take extraordinary measures to pursue the war, above all, necessary to appease and not antagonize Paris and its turbulent populace. Put another way, those who saw these things as necessities were willing to sacrifice the principles of 1789 under pressure of circumstances, even to the extent, finally, in June 1793, of allowing the sans-culottes to purge the national representation itself and get rid of the group of vocal deputies whom they hated, the Girondins. Now, I'm not the first to suggest it. That was perhaps Fernand Braudel, in a throwaway line in The Identity of France, the sort of thing he was so good at stimulating, but thoroughly unsubstantiated, that the true revolutionaries, he called them, were not the Montagnards who triumphed in June 1793. They were the Girondins at whose expense that triumph was achieved. And if you look at the record, as Alison Patrick did as long ago as 1972, through an analysis of voting in the convention on pivotal issues, it's the Girondins who emerge as the ones not prepared to compromise basic principles just because the convention was surrounded in Paris by bloodthirsty sans-culottes. Girondins believed in national sovereignty rather than the self-conferred popular sovereignty of a few thousand Parisians. Representing provincial constituencies, they couldn't see why Paris had the right to dictate to the rest of the nation, especially when the deputies of Paris numbered among them people like Marat, whose solution to every problem was massacre, and whose followers had put that reflex into practice in September 1792. Although it had taken popular action, all right, to bring down the Bastille, massacre and mobs taking the law into their own hands had not been what the revolution was supposed to be. Paris also wanted the king killed. Indeed, ideally, Paris wanted no trial either, regarding the monarch, as Saint-Just and Robespierre argued, as guilty by the very act of insurrection. It's the Girondins who insisted on a trial. All right, so they voted him guilty along with everybody else, because there really was no other possible verdict. But they then wanted to proceed in an extremely regular and principled way. If the sovereign nation at large really believed him guilty as well, it should have the chance to confirm its representative's decision. And if the nation was sovereign, it should have the chance to exercise the clemency, which was always a sovereign's inalienable prerogative, especially when the condemned man was the nation's former king. The way proposed for doing it was by referendum. It's a political idea with a long but ambiguous future, first floated as a way of consulting the sovereign nation by the Pétion in 1789. Excuse me. But all these are questions of principle, questions of law, which should be beyond the transient pressures brought by Parisian mobs. They lost the votes on these issues, but the Girondins, so often still referred to as moderates, were nothing of the sort. They indignantly rejected the description at the time. They were radicals who stood for first principles rather than forced principles. And the same is true if we turn to economic questions. The Girondins opposed the maximum. They genuinely believed in the Enlightenment's economic doctrine that production and exchange should be allowed to operate naturally, freed of artificial constraints. Quite apart from the fact that price controls were an interference with rights of property, controls disrupted the market, made it function less efficiently. The revolution had provided the opportunity for the principles of economic freedom to be embraced wholeheartedly after 30 years of governmental dithering, uncertainty, set in thoughts on the part of the dying old regime. No wonder the sans-culottes hated the Girondins. For them, the revolution had brought an opportunity to stop all that flirting with fancy theories which pushed up the cost of living, and to get back to a moral economy of just prices and assured supplies. Well, eventually, after much foot dragging, the Montagnards accepted that they had to go along with this. It was the only practical thing to do. And so the maximum was introduced in the teeth of Girondin opposition. In fact, a lot of things happened over that winter in the teeth of Girondin opposition. And this is the greatest of all the lessons taught us by Alice and Patrick, but again, one that doesn't seem to have sunk in fully. They did not have a reliable majority in the convention. They were not even the largest voting bloc. They lost most of the big votes, and those they won were largely achieved because so many Montagnards, practical men, able to get things done, were absent from Paris on mission. So the purge of 29 Girondin deputies on the 2nd of June 1793 was not necessary to clear the way for a Montagnard majority. The Montagnard could normally muster that already. And that makes all the more sense of the doubts that so many, even of them, had about the legitimacy of the purge. The necessity came from the fact that the sans-culotte seemed to be threatening the very existence of the convention if their all too vocal critics were not silenced. It's a choice between a purged convention or perhaps no convention at all. And things had come to this pass in the view of many Montagnards because the Girondins seemed incapable of keeping their mouth shut. Danton even begged them just to shut up and stop attacking Paris. But talented orators, as several of them undoubtedly were, they found it hard to resist the allure of windy rhetoric. It's the oratory of future Girondins which had whipped the Legislative Assembly into war fever against the lonely advice of Robespierre in the Jacobin Club over the winter of 1791-2. And then when the French began to win battles the following autumn, it's at Girondin urging that the convention offered fraternity and help to all people seeking to recover their liberty. A wildly open-ended offer, which was discreetly rescinded in April 1793. It's that Montagnard majority again. Some Montagnards, including Robespierre, had even denounced Girondin rhetoric about human rights for provoking the great slave rebellion in Saint-Domingue. It's true that several months after the Girondin went to the guillotine, it was the Montagnard Convention which promulgated the first general slave emancipation in history. But again, that was a practical response to the situation on the ground in Saint-Domingue, rather than evidence of any long-standing convictions. Several future Girondins, by contrast, had been very active during its brief existence in the Amis des Noirs, the French abolitionist society co-founded by Brissot. And in fact, emancipation was first proclaimed in Saint-Domingue by commissioners chosen and sent out on the recommendation of Brissot. And after the purge of the Girondins, the Montagnards had recalled those commissioners as suspects, but by then it was too late. Then a further example of their radical credentials is offered by the Cercle Social. Much play was once made by left-wing analysts with this radical debating club of 1790-1, and its newspaper, the Bouche de Fer. Writers from Marx to Mathias saw it as its deliberations as the cutting edge of social and political radicalism, a foretaste of Jacobinism of the year two. But as long ago as 1985, Gary Cates reminded us that it was largely future Girondins rather than Montagnard who ran the Cercle Social and continued its work as a publishing house after it was closed down in the reaction following the flight to Varennes. Its founder, Fouché, who stuck with the Constituent Assembly's religious policy long enough to become a constitutional bishop, he went to the guillotine as a Girondin. As I noted earlier, the very term sans-culotte was first used by a Girondin, and at that stage with positive approval. Michael Sonnenscher, who reminded us of this, has intriguingly discovered that Robespierre initially denounced future Girondins as protectors of the sans-culotte. It's also been shown, I think, that the men who would emerge as Girondins in 1792-3 had already, on the eve of the revolution, begun to think about representative government rather than the direct democracy that Rousseau had declared was the only legitimate sort of republicanism and which the Montagnards and sans-culottes kept mouthing allegiance to throughout the year too. These theorists in the circles around Brissot, who was the first identifiable leader of those later called Girondins, and Clavière, whom he shoehorned into the finance ministry in the spring of 1792 saw that the values articulated by Rousseau could only be made work through a sort of moral dictatorship that would smother all the other values that a proper system of government should be committed to protecting. They thought it obvious, as indeed Rousseau himself admitted, that his ideas could not work in any polity larger than a small city-state. Or take all the work that's been done over the last generation or so on the revolution and women. What it's shown is that the Montagnards, again, along with Rousseau, were extremely wary of women's involvement in public affairs and politics. For them, a woman's place was in the home, looking after the men, having children, bringing them up as patriots. The Girondins, by contrast, were much more liberal towards the private and public claims of women. It was the Girondin-dominated last rump of the Legislative Assembly which legalized divorce in September 1792. The Girondins were supported by the most prominent revolutionary so-called Amazons like Olympe de Gouges or Théroigne de Méricourt. One of their political powerhouses was the household of Madame Roland, whom the Montagnards really hated. And the leading intellectual spokesman for values that the Girondins espoused in the legislative and the convention, Condorcet, had a long record in arguing for complete political equality for women. Now that really was revolutionary, so much so that it was not achieved in France until 1944. It was doubtless no more than a coincidence, though a striking one, that the Montagnard Convention closed down women's political clubs on the very day that the leading Girondins were condemned to death on the 30th of October, 1793. And it's instructive to read the transcripts of the trial. Despite insistent calls from the sans-culottes over the summer, the Montagnards were very dilatory in bringing them to trial at all. They recognized that at the moment of the purge, none of its victims had really done anything deserving trial before the Revolutionary Tribunal. And Lee Whaley has persuasively argued, in fact, that the Girondins perished for what happened after the purge rather than before it. For the way many of them evaded very loose arrest to throw in their lot with the provincial rebels of the so-called Federalist Revolt, and thereby were presumed to have incited Charlotte Corday from the Federalist hotbed of Caen to murder the sans-culottes hero Marat. This conduct was enough to open them to the charge for which they were eventually condemned, that of conspiring against the unity and indivisibility of the Republic. But if I'm right about their basic radicalism, it makes their cries from the dock of Vive la République seem more than just the bitter reaction of victims of a rigged show trial, and their defiant singing of the Marseillaise on their way to the guillotine, a final heroic gesture. Now, in the light of all this, the year two, far from being a radical high point, looks much more like a conservative crackdown during the defeat and aftermath of a civil war, a suspension of liberties in the name of national security. Now, that doesn't make it the culmination of a long-laid plan for a dictatorship by a Machiavellian Robespierre and his friends, as Jonathan Israel has argued, but he is right, I think, in arguing that the Girondins represented the core values of the revolution. So far from being the essence of the revolution, the Republic of the Year Two looks much more like an aberration, much more like a loss of direction. The quintessence of the revolution lay elsewhere, as the deputies in the convention recognized when, in the months after Thermidor, they dismantled revolutionary government, relaxed central control, scrap the maximum, and not least, release the so-called 75 deputies who had been suspended and later imprisoned for protesting against the purging of the Girondins in June 1793. Among them was Tom Paine, the greatest international revolutionary of the age, who'd been closely associated with the Girondins since the days of the Cercle Social and the crisis of the fight to Varennes, and had voted with them in the convention. These Girondin sympathizers now played their part in drafting the constitution of the year three, a clear attempt to get French political life back to first principles with its divided executive, strict separation of powers, annual elections, and a franchise heavily dependent on property qualifications. It was the 1791 constitution, modified in the light of intervening experience, which had exposed certain fundamental mistakes. But one mistake the Thermidorians did not recognize, perhaps because at this stage in the revolution, it didn't look like one. What had really gone wrong? What had really blown the revolution, of course, and undermined the principles of 1789 was the war. Now, war had not been on the revolution's original agenda. In 1790, in fact, the constituent renounced war as an instrument of national policy, except in self-defense. It was those only now coming to be called Girondins in the Legislative Assembly who introduced war as a way of resolving the problems bequeathed by the constituent. They were full of bombastic confidence that a revolutionary people would sweep all before it. And it was the Girondins who, in the euphoria of victory after a decidedly shaky start, offered fraternity and help to all peoples seeking to reclaim their liberty, and proclaimed that wherever the French armies went, they would impose their anti-aristocratic social program of the revolution. Now, the practical and pragmatic Montagnard were much more equivocal about what war might do. And once it began to go badly, as Robespierre had warned it might, it was they who recognized that defeat could only be averted by extraordinary emergency measures. And the Girondins had hardly begun to confront this problem before they fell. They thought that the revolution's principles were, or ought to be, proof against all circumstances. The Thermidorians, with the foreign enemies now in retreat on all fronts, might be forgiven for thinking the same. In 1795, the great nation seemed unstoppable. So it was time to give it a constitution enshrining the revolution's original principles, which had been so subverted after the Girondins had been purged. And for all the scorn that the Directory had attracted from almost every ideological standpoint, I think there is a sort of pathetic heroism about the way that, despite all its obvious inadequacies, those who designed it tried to make the Constitution of the Year Three work. They still believed, however dimly, in both the rightness and the strength of the revolutionary principles of 1789. But war, launched to defend them, had fatally exposed their inadequacies. And it had also led, through the unavoidable creation of a powerful army after half a decade of military decay and neglect, to the emergence of a new power for which none of the revolutionary constitutions made much explicit provision. It's certainly ironic, but perhaps appropriate, that the man who finally destroyed the Republic was a general thrown up by the war which the Girondins launched, and someone who had begun his successful career in 1793 as a Jacobin and a protege of Robespierre.
Thank you, Bill, very much. I don't know, can you hear me? Yes.
Yes.
I'm just, the video is just coming now. That's it. Hello, good evening. I'm Nicholas Cronk. I'm the director of the Voltaire Foundation. And thank you, Bill, so very much for that wonderful lecture. What you've just given us is an absolutely magisterial overview of the revolution. You've remapped for us what happened in the revolution. You've also remapped what is, for literary scholars like myself, almost the oldest question that I started with as an undergraduate, which is how do the writers of French literature in the 18th century link to the revolution? And the first authors I read as a literature student were Gustave Lanson and, of course, his favourite pupil, Daniel Mornay. And the question they first asked was, what was the connection between the philosophe and the Enlightenment? A question which you couldn't really ask in more recent years, and you've actually legitimized a whole new area of inquiry. Thank you very much. That was a wonderful lecture. I'm sure that will provoke lots of questions, and it's a huge pleasure to hand over for the Q&A. I'm passing over, and I should say, just before I hand over, I want to say thank you for mentioning Hugh Trevor Roper. I don't know whether you knew, but he was Bestman's literary executor. And when we began the Bestman lectures, now 20 years ago, he came to the early lectures and was a very convivial presence at those early lectures. So it was a very nice link. Now a very good friend, Lauren Clay, who is Professor of History at Vanderbilt. And we know each other from being researchers together in Paris. So it's nice to be talking to you in Nashville, Tennessee, Lauren. Lauren is a specialist of the Ancien Régime and the Revolution. She's written a wonderful book, Stage Struck, about the business of theatre in the Ancien Régime and its colonies. And she's an author in the Oxford Handbook of the French Revolution. And it's my huge pleasure, Lauren, to hand over to you to organise the questions and answers. Thank you, Lauren.
Wonderful. Good. Am I up and running?
You are.
Okay, good. I just want to remind all the audience members who are watching this through YouTube that you can write your questions or comments into the comment or live chat, and they will be transmitted to me. And I'd like to briefly thank Nicholas Cronk and Greg Brown for inviting me to participate in this 2020 Bestman Lecture. And especially to Professor Doyle for delivering such an elegant and provocative lecture. I noticed that in his discussion of the historiography of the French Revolution, Professor Doyle omitted his own essential contribution to the revisionist critique of the Marxist paradigm, Origins of the French Revolution, which has been a staple of PhD comprehensive exam lists for generations now. Again and again throughout his career, Professor Doyle has written scholarship that has demanded that scholars rethink what they know about the revolution, about the aristocracy, about venality, and I could go on. And today's talk was really no different. In this lecture, Professor Doyle asks the question, who were the French revolutionaries, before offering up an unexpected answer, seeking to rehabilitate the allegedly moderate Girondins as the real true revolutionaries. He sets out to rescue them from both the malice of their Jacobin enemies and from the condescension of posterity. I was especially struck by Professor Doyle's argument that the Girondins' credentials as true revolutionaries were stronger than the Jacobins because they were more deeply committed to, quote, establishing the rule of law in all circumstances. As early as 1776, in the revolutionary pamphlet Common Sense, the future Girondin sympathizer Tom Paine articulated this as a bedrock principle of democratic revolutions. He argued that, quote, for as in absolute governments the king is law, so in free countries, the law ought to be king. In the French Revolution, as we have seen today, the fundamental legal principles were laid out in the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen. Over the next few years, however, the rule of law confronted exceptional challenges, both domestic and foreign, including the direct interventions of the people of Paris. So I wanted to ask you, Professor Doyle, if you might develop for us a bit more how the Girondins conceptualized law as the expression of popular sovereignty. To what extent did they focus on ideals, and to what extent were they concerned with institutions and everyday practices? And I think this may come to mind given certain ongoing circumstances in which we realize the value of both ideals and institutions and practices for upholding representative government. And moreover, is this account of the Girondins as the true revolutionaries perhaps complicated by the fact that during the Directory, the Latter-day Girondins proved willing to undermine law and popular sovereignty by repeatedly voiding election results? So that was a question that I wanted to pose.
Yeah, well, I think you remember me saying right at the beginning that the fundamental revolutionary act is the 17th of June, 1789, when national sovereignty is proclaimed. And the point that the Girondins make repeatedly is that the convention represents the whole nation rather than just the people of Paris. And the people of Paris kept talking and saying, the people want this, the people want that, and so on. And the Girondins kept saying, well, look, you know, you are not the people, you're just part of the people. You are dominating the representatives of the rest of the nation who are not really getting a say in what's going on. And in that sense, I think, you know, they are trying to go back to the original founding principle of the whole revolution of national sovereignty. Now, when it comes to the later Girondins, after Thermidor, many former Girondins are restored and so on, and I've argued that they tried to get back to the principles of 89, that the real problem there is that the voters to whom who embodied the will of the nation, in fact, were liable to vote for a king. And that was the real problem. The first time you get anything like proper elections under the post-Thermidorian regime is the elections of the spring of 1797, when they produce this great right-wing majority, which, you know, what it's going to do, it's going to bring back the king unless you stop it. And therefore you get the coup of Fructidor, which attempts to stop that, and they realize that actually the only way their constitution can work is by repeatedly being remodeled from the center. It feels like it is a betrayal in some ways, but as I said at the end, there's a sort of pathetic heroism in some ways, saying, you know, we've got to keep this constitution going, even if we have to violate it repeatedly in order to do it. But, you know, they don't say, let's scrap the whole damn thing. It's Napoleon who says that, who comes along and said, let's scrap it. They say, no, we've got this constitution, and although we are playing around with it all the time to prevent royalists from getting a majority, nevertheless, it's still worth doing. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So I now have the pleasure of calling on and introducing three colleagues who have been invited to comment briefly on Professor Doyle's lecture and also to offer their own questions. So first, I would like to introduce Brian Banks, who is Assistant Professor of History at Columbus State University. Brian is the co-editor of The French Revolution in Global Perspective, Freedom and Faith. He is also the co-founder and executive editor of Age of Revolutions, an online journal. So thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Lauren. Thank you, conveners, for asking me to come along and ask a question, make a comment. And thank you, Bill Doyle, for such a thoughtful paper. When I first received your paper, I actually went over to my bookshelf to revisit your vast corpus, and I found that I have three copies of your Oxford History of the French Revolution, which I think is a real testament to just how important it is that, like an invasive species or something, it's made its way into my office time and time again. That's all a very, you know, a good compliment. Bill, like his teacher, Hugh Trevor Roper, says you should never give away too much in a title. The title of the paper we've heard today is Who Were the French Revolutionaries? Which, after hearing this paper, I think we all realize is deceptively simple. In our age of search engines and data analytics, though, I can tell you that you need to give away far more in your title if you want people to find you, especially if you don't have the kind of historiographical clout that Bill does. So as a historian of the French Revolution and an editor of Age of Revolutions, a digital publication, I thought I'd alter Bill's title just very quickly here to "Who were the French Revolutionaries? The Girondins, period." And like Lauren, I was surprised to come across this interesting argument. One of the questions Bill hints at throughout the paper, I think, is actually whose French revolutionaries, though? The Marxists saw the Montagnards as the true revolutionaries and inheritors of the class conflict which brought the ascendancy of the capitalist bourgeois French Revolution of 1789. Bill points us to the Girondins, building on the work of post-revisionists who've researched the context and contingency of the political debates of the revolution specifically. If you cut away all the politicking, the Girondins, in Doyle's account, were the staunchest defenders of the ideas of 1789 as borne out in the debates themselves. They were radicals who stood for first principles rather than forced principles. And I really liked that one. I really liked that line, Bill. This was the story the Girondins also told themselves too, right? Eschewing claims of their moderate politics and claiming the mantle of 1789. In doing so, both historically and historiographically, each group also defines what 1789 stood for in order to define the true revolutionaries. So Bill's answer to the question, who were the French revolutionaries, is interesting and framed in a novel fashion. I wonder if Bill might address a connected question, a kind of a larger one. Why specifically should the Girondins be given so much credit for their self-identification? Other groups imagined themselves as defending the ideals of 1789 too, and they crafted those ideals to serve their purposes, right? Certainly the Montagnards did, as did the radical Sans-Culottes, as did to some extent the enslaved masses in Saint-Domingue or colonial Haiti, as some scholars are calling it now, as did the Quaker Commission to the National Constituent Assembly in 1791, which I've written on, as did women marching on Versailles. Claiming to hold fast to the ideals of 1789 is a political statement in and of itself, I think. So if I might then don my Roger Chartier hat for a moment, why should we be focused on identifying the Girondins as the quintessential French revolutionaries, rather than examining the field of constructions of revolutionary identity, some retrospective and others born from the revolutionary cauldron of 1789 itself? Thank you, Bill.
Well, what we're looking at it is a body which claims to be speaking for the nation, which has been elected by the nation, the convention. I mean, most of this debate revolves around what happens between the fall of the monarchy and the purge of the Girondins in June 1793. And this is the point at which that body, the convention, is, if anybody is, in control of what's going on in France. And therefore, who's important there and what they stand for is really central to the history of the revolution. Now, you're quite right. In all sorts of other areas, far from Paris, far from the convention, there are people interpreting what the revolution means in their own way. That's absolutely right. But the Girondins have been looked at too often, it seems to me, as the moderates who were defeated by the radicals. And this is such a central question to the whole history of the revolution, that this is what I felt it ought to be concentrated, really ought to concentrate on. And the idea of Girondin moderation keeps coming up. I mean, it's there in Jeremy Popkin's most recent survey, it's an excellent survey of the revolution. But Jeremy says, you know, that the Girondins are the moderates. You know, and what I'd like to do is kill that idea for future textbook writers, as it were. And therefore, that's why I concentrate on that. But I certainly wouldn't deny that there are other groups in much wider areas for whom the revolution stands for something much different.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Excellent. For our next guest, I am pleased to introduce Christy Picchicaro. Christy is Associate Professor of History and French at George Mason University. She is a literary scholar and cultural historian specializing in race, gender, and war in the early modern French Empire. Welcome, Christy.
Thank you so much, Lauren. And thank you so much, Bill, also for this wonderful paper and these incredible ideas that we have come to expect from you. So thank you for delivering. So my question takes up some of the themes that Brian just brought up in a slightly more pointed way, taking up your primary query of who were the French revolutionaries. And what I'd like to do is sort of weave together two of your analytical gestures that I find particularly significant and generative in turning our gaze toward the future of French revolutionary studies. The first is your revisiting of the historiography and highlighting of the historians and arguments that challenged scholarly doxa and affected monumental epistemic shifts in revolutionary studies. You yourself, of course, have been a driver of this and engage in such an exercise with these questions that you put forward. What was the revolution really about? And aren't those who believed in these principles the real revolutionaries? And then I think this critical question, who might this analytical framing let in? And who might this exclude? In your answer, as we've seen, you challenge quite persuasively, I think, the predominant focus on the sans-culottes, the Jacobins, and Robespierre in favor of a serious reevaluation of the beliefs and works of the Girondins. So thank you for that. This leads me to the second gesture that I'd like to highlight, and this goes to what Brian has mentioned, that of mentioning women revolutionaries and also the critical question of slavery and human rights. So considering your criteria for rehabilitating the Girondins as the true revolutionaries, wouldn't individuals like Vincent Auger and Julien Raymond, two mixed race planters from Saint-Domingue who fought with pen and sword for the extension of revolutionary principles to those like them, not to all, but to those like them, should not these figures be also included in the list? How might we consider Dadi Boukman, or Cécile Fatimont, who led the ceremony at Bois Caïman in August 1791 that preceded the slave revolt in Saint-Domingue? And what of Toussaint Louverture and Jean-François and Georges Biassou? So my question is, if we think of the collective biographies of great men and women that the French so liked to compile during the 18th century and a broader chronology than that, but that we all use as sources, how might we begin to envision a different pantheon of revolutionaries that includes the varied positionalities and real commitments to those first principles of the French Revolution? Thank you so much.
Yeah, well, I mean, so the names which you have mentioned are absolutely central to current debates, aren't they, about the revolution in the Caribbean and so on. Much of it boils down to the question of agency, isn't it? I mean, agency is central to the discussion of that. And although I can quite see, and you talked about people like Auger, you talked about people like Boukman and so on, who clearly have enormously important in pushing forward that. See, it's always seemed to me that if authority had not collapsed in France, a lot of that agency would have had no opportunity to burst out. Now, I'm sure that's a controversial thing, but it seems to me so much depends on that. And those who are putting forward the most sympathetic line in France, not very many sympathetic lines are coming out of France, and they're not very radical either, but those who are most sympathetic to people like Auger, perhaps not Boukman, but certainly Auger, are the Girondins, in effect, the Amis des Noirs, Brissot, and his friends, who are all the time saying, you know, we must first of all give equal rights to people of color, and then we think about the question of the slaves as well, and so on. And who's criticizing them all the time about this? Robespierre. Robespierre is saying, you are stirring the blacks up, and it's your rhetoric which is doing it. You know, the idea that of the Montagnard being radical on that one, it seems to me, it just doesn't fit. If you're looking for a radicalism there, or people with minds open to widening political rights to people who aren't white, then the Girondins are the people you need.
Thank you.
Yeah. Wonderful. So we have a third colleague I'd like to introduce. Finally, here is Dr. Minchul Kim, Assistant Professor of History at Sun Kyun Kwan University in Seoul. Professor Kim is an intellectual historian of the Enlightenment and the French Revolution. Thank you.
Thank you so much for this fascinating and stimulating lecture. As a student, I've always read your books, and this is an honor for me to be questioning you with, you've just criticized the classical or say Marxist assessment of revolutionary factions, and you have claimed the Girondins as the true revolutionaries on the basis that true revolutionaries were those who believed in the principles of the revolution. And following this, you've also questioned if the Montagnards really qualify as upholders of the ideology of 1789. And I'll say, yes, the Girondins were radicals, and in many respects, they were indeed more radical than any other factions in the revolution. And this is all made very clear by recent scholarship as well. And dubbing them moderates doesn't work anymore. And that said, I must confess, I feel a bit skeptical about measuring the trueness or, say, sincerity of the revolutionaries by their ideological commitments to certain principles, even though, as an intellectual historian, I cannot agree with you more that it's important to acknowledge the revolution was a child of the Enlightenment. So what I mean is, what is a revolution if it is not about actually realizing the principles in spite of practical obstacles? As you've made clear, the Girondins were most deeply committed to the revolution's agreed first principles and carried them further than anyone else. However, the Montagnards were also committed to the principles of the revolution. And we remember Robespierre shouting, Paris la colonie. And rather than simply abandoning the principles, the Montagnards, I think, tried to channel the passions of popular rage, or I'd say the irresistible force chose, towards protecting the seeds of the cherished principles against the calamities of international and civil wars, as you've mentioned. So to sum up, say, could you develop further if we are to label all of this, all the Montagnards and the revolutionary, or what you've just called the anti-revolutionary government, as an abandonment of truly revolutionary principles, and uphold the Girondins as the true radicals against the Montagnards, what would be the interpretative merit of such a framework in understanding the revolutionary dynamics? Thank you so much.
Well, if you are committed to the range of values which are established in 1789, this is why I tried to say, you know, that they put up a copy of the Declaration in the new convention hall in May, you know, in other words, these are our basic principles. We're all committed to those and so on. What the Girondins appeared to think, as far as I can see, you know, is if these principles are sound and if they're good and if they work, they should be applicable and they should be proof against all circumstances. Whereas what the Montagnards are saying is, look, you know, this, let's be practical. This, they have got to be suspended because we're facing an emergency, and the worst of that emergency that the country was facing actually came after the purge. You know, after the purge, you've got the Federalist Revolt, the Vendée Revolt going on all the time, the fall of Toulon, and everything like that. It really looks really bad. Now, most of that happens after the Girondins have been purged. The Girondins were not actually faced with the problem of a practical response to a national emergency. It's just beginning when they are thrown out. And one reason they're thrown out is I think, because they say, no, we can't suspend things. We can't have an emergency suspension of our principles, because our principles are the ones that really matter. It all seems to work when you're invading other countries and the armies of the despots are falling back beyond. It showed, you know, that a free people can do this sort of thing. But when that is going wrong, when it's a time of defeat, which it is from February 1793 right through to the end of the year, then you've got the practical men, the Montagnards say, look, you know, we have just got to suspend things. And literally they do suspend them. They, you know, they bring out the constitution, then they suspend it from wires, from the roof of the convention hall, in fact, until the war is over. You know, the proclamation of revolutionary government is the government of France is revolutionary until the peace. What that involves is turning upside down a whole range of principles which have been established in 89. They're suspended because of the emergency. And if you like, the difference between the Girondins and the Montagnards is the Girondins are starry-eyed believers and the Montagnards say, look, we've got to be practical about this. What I don't believe, if I may add to that, what I don't believe is, you know, part of what I've said chimes in very well with Jonathan Israel's arguments about revolutionary ideas, in the sense, because I think he would agree with me, or rather I'd agree with him, you know, about the radicalism of the Girondins. But what he also says is, you've got a determined and ambitious plot by Robespierre and his friends to take over the government and turn the country into a dictatorship. I don't think that was there. I don't think that was what was really happening. It's they do see it as temporary, but you know, how do you get out of it? And that's the problem that that they face in the spring of 1794. And the only way they can find the way out of it is to find a scapegoat, and Robespierre is there for that.
Yeah, I can see that was more tragic than what Jonathan Israel has said. Okay, thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you so much. So there are a number of questions in the chat, and I think more are coming in. So let's turn to some of those. So here's the first. Given the popularity of the Girondins in the provinces and the Federalist Revolt, is it fair to suggest that the provinces were more liberal and revolutionary than they have been given credit for?
Yes, I think it is. Except that, you know, there's one area of the provinces where they're certainly not liberal, and that's the Vendée. That is the West. That is the royalist West, and that's somewhat different. And the Girondins were always at pains insofar as they could make their voices felt after the 2nd of June 1793. They're always at pains to say, we are not royalists, we are Republicans. And we don't want to be identified with royalists. But the Montagnard response to that was, you may not want to be identified with them, but you are doing their work. They're useful idiots, if you like, and that's why you must be stopped.
Here's another one. Thanks, Bill. Although conquered, could the sister republics be a neo-Girondin attempt to introduce national sovereignty, so reconnecting the exigencies of the war with the first principles of 1789?
Well, the sister republics are a difficult business, really. I mean, so the first of the sister republics is in fact the Dutch Republic, the Batavian Republic, in effect, and that comes out of many native Dutch circumstances, as it were. And it proves very difficult to graft French principles onto what's happening, onto the historically formed set of political life in the Dutch Republic. The other sister republics are created by Napoleon. And he says, you know, okay, we're going to have these... They're all going to represent a national sovereignty of their own, but basically what they are strategic buffers for France. That's how Napoleon, he's a soldier, that's how Napoleon actually sees it. So I don't think he's, and you look at the way he treats the Cisalpine Republic, for example, you know, he's not interested really in instituting sound republican values there so much as making sure that this state actually serves French strategic purposes.
I have another. Thank you for your lecture. To what extent can we speak about the Girondins as a group when there's limited cohesion in Sydenham's inner 60? in their public votes before the Commission of 12.
Yeah, well, this is one of the basic problems that the historiography from Sydenham onwards has actually addressed, the question of how far there is uniformity. And there isn't uniform. They don't pull together as a party. I mean, say, if you like, the inner core of the Montagnards act far more like a political party than anything the Girondins ever do. But there's a sort of baggy attitude, if you like. Baggy is a terrible word, but it sums it up, really. You know, it's a collection of attitudes which overlap to some degree and sometimes don't. The group comes together, and I mean, say, if you look, Sydenham talks about that certain number of people, but in fact, if you look at Alison Patrick's calculation on her definition of what a Girondin is, it's much bigger than that. It comes to something like 170 or something like that. Sydenham is absolutely right, and Patrick accepts that they are not a political party, and they shouldn't be treated as a political party. But they represent, if you like, a bundle of related attitudes. That's why I say baggy, a bundle of related attitudes which are different from those espoused by the Montagnards, certainly over the winter of 1792-3.
Here's another. Thank you very much for your brilliant lecture. Could you please explain the difference of your interpretation to that of Furet?
Furet?
Yeah.
Well, Furet is overwhelmingly an intellectual argument, and the essence of what Furet is saying is that terror is inherent from the start in revolutionary ideologies. It's inherent from the start proclamation of national sovereignty and the inability of the revolutionary ideology to accommodate the idea of opposition. That's the difference. It seems to me I can't see the terror as inevitable from the start at all. Seems to me it arises out of the circumstances of the war, and the war is certainly not inevitable from the start. So that's the difference. Furet sees a unity in the whole thing. He's back to Georges Clemenceau's famous argument, you know, you've got to take the revolution as a block. It's all one. You've got to take it all, whether you like it or not. It all hangs together. And Furet takes it back to that. Whereas it seems to me that it's a series of events, many of which depend on contingencies and therefore are not predictable and not foreseeable right from the start. So that's where I would differ.
Wonderful. We have just more than 5 minutes left, just to give everyone a sense of the time, and still a number of questions in our queue. The next one up, can you tell us whether there's a basis in the retrospect of the revolution to see those who lost status or value from their pre-revolutionary venal offices as having a particular political tendency during the revolution? Is there any link that you can draw?
No, I don't think so. The thing that's always struck me, and when I was working on the history of venality, I wrote a chapter on the abolition of venality, and what struck me, the interesting thing was the number of holders of offices and so on who were perfectly happy to see their offices abolished, even though the compensation that they were voting was not any way reflected, did not in any way reflect the value of those offices. They made a real sacrifice because they thought it was a good thing to get rid of those offices. And I think this is one of the things which historians tend to underestimate about the French Revolution, is it is shot through with altruism of various sorts. And some of that is exhibited by the Girondins.
Another question from our chats. why should we define quote unquote real revolutionaries through the principles of a 1789 text instead of through the practical actions in defense of the revolution by people across France in the years after?
But I have to throw that question back and say, well, you know, what revolution are they defending? Practical actions in you know, I mean, the people whom the questioner says is are acting in defense of the revolution, they're presumably trying to defend a set of principles as much as the Girondins whom I've been talking about. You know, it's a question of how you define this revolution that you're involved in.
Okay, just time for one or two more. Thank you very much. What can the study of transatlantic conversations or interactions reveal about the meaning of quote unquote revolutionaries?
Well, I mean, Keith Baker's gone into this history of what the word revolution, hasn't he? And how it changes, as it were. And it begins to change, obviously, with what happens in North America. But I mean, to start with, the revolution in North America is conceived in the same terms that other 18th century revolutions were. It's not seen as having the totally radical, total transformational meaning that it acquires with the French Revolution. Now people can then look back, and people have looked back and said, look, actually the American Revolution is very revolutionary indeed in the way it challenges all sorts of established institutions and attitudes throughout the former 13 colonies. That's absolutely right. But until the French Revolution comes along, I think the modern idea of what a revolution is isn't fully developed. The ambitions of the French Revolution proved to be so comprehensive, in effect, that they affect everything. Whereas, you know, it's easy, first of all, with the American Revolution, to say, well, this is actually just throwing off British authority and things carry on as before. Now we know that actually removing British authority opens the way to all sorts of fundamental questions about what sort of society or what sort of societies the 13 colonies are going to be. The French Revolution isn't like that. It's not throwing off an outside authority. It's self-transformation, if you like.
We could also see that question as relating to the revolution in Saint-Domingue as well, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, certainly, yes, yes.
Wonderful. Okay. Well, this has been an extraordinary event, and I would very much like to thank you for such a wonderful, thought-provoking lecture, and also to the Voltaire Foundation for making all of this possible. So I'm going to turn things over to Greg Brown to kind of close us out here.
Thank you so much, Lauren. And I just want to, on behalf of the Voltaire Foundation, just thank everyone who was involved. Karen O'Brien, the Director of the Division of Humanities at the University of Oxford, Professor Clay, Minchul Kim, Christy Picachero, Brian Banks, thank you all so much. And thank you to the Oxford Research Center in the Humanities and their staff for doing all the technical support that made this event possible. And above all, thank you to Professor Doyle for your participation for this marvelous lecture. And thank you, I should finally close with thank you to Nicholas Cronk, the director of the Foundation, for putting this all together. Thanks again for participating. And please do continue to follow the Voltaire Foundation events, which are posted on the website.